You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Thank you all for coming and joining us. I'm Jeremy Polofsky. I'm a correspondent with Reuters News Service here in D.C. I cover the Justice Department and Homeland Security, and previously have covered the Federal Communications Commission and other issues, related issues. To my right is Mark Zwillinger, who's the founding partner of Zwillinger Janetsky LLP, and he provides legal advice to clients on how the on internet practices, including the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, Wiretap Communications Act, CAN-SPAM, FISA, and related laws. To his right is Kevin Bankston, who's a senior attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where they litigate on a regular basis the privacy issues. And to his right is Bruce Hyman, who is with K&L Gates, and he has a practice there on assisting clients on computer software, information technology, and the telecommunications industry. And to his right, at the very end, is Bruce Schneier, who's the Chief Security Technology Officer at British Telecom. And he's a well-known security technologist and author. So what I thought we would do is chat up here for a little bit. I'll pose some questions to the panelists, and then we'll open it up for your questions with about 15 minutes left to go. So, and I want to thank the Internet Caucus for putting this on. It's a very timely issue, especially with the start of the new Congress, and probably a big effort by the Obama administration to see if they can't get some legislation passed on the potential expansion of wiretapping. So we know the administration, particularly the FBI, is anxious to update and expand its surveillance capabilities. They point to a number of plots, whether it be criminal or terrorism related, that they feel they need this information. They have complained that it's too time-consuming to go back to pull this kind of information, and that they need to monitor it sometimes in real time. We've seen a number of plots using all sorts of technology. The Times Square car bomb plot involved emails and other related internet traffic. There are traditional crimes that we would consider more criminal in nature and less terrorism related. Earlier today, prosecutors filed a complaint against two individuals who are allegedly responsible for the hack of the iPad customer data. So they pulled chats from internet relay conversations and chat rooms, and all sorts of information from internet-based sources. So I'm going to also try and play a little bit of the devil's advocate and sort of the government role, since we don't have a government rep here. So the three key issues I'd like to focus on with the panel is what kind of impact of such surveillance requests from the government, law enforcement, is going to have on service providers and equipment makers, balancing the need of the law enforcement, what they need, versus the Constitution and privacy, and then how all this will play out in the Congress with a new legislature taking shape. So let's start with the business angle, and you know, feel free to jump in on top of me at any time or on top of each other, but I'll try and keep it flowing. Is this concern, let's start off with the basics, is this concern that significant of the FBI wanting this power? Do you want to start, Kevin?
Is the concern significant, or is the problem they seek to address significant? Let's start with the latter. Obviously, it's kind of hard to criticize a proposal when we don't know what it is. We are kind of shadow boxing here, but basically the gist of what we've seen in the press is that the FBI wants to extend CALEA, that is mandated intercept capability, to some broad swath of internet communications providers beyond the broadband providers and VoIP providers that are already covered. They want some way of getting the plain text of encrypted communications, and they want some way of intercepting peer-to-peer communications, which are difficult to intercept because they are indeed peer-to-peer and don't go through a centralized service. To our mind at EFF, this seems like a rather drastic solution, drastic anti-privacy, anti-security, anti-innovation solution, and I'll explain why I think those things. In search of a problem, based on the government's own numbers about electronic intercepts, about internet intercepts, we look at the wiretap report from 2009, for example, that covers federal law enforcement. And there were, at most, 7 electronic intercepts in 2009. I say at most because one of them was purely electronic, 6 of them were combinations, which is electronic in combination with oral or wire. And so at most we had 7 federal law enforcement internet wiretaps. Only one of them encountered encryption, which is one of the big stated concerns. And encryption ultimately did not prevent the government from getting the information it wanted. So even if you extrapolate that to FISA wiretaps, FISA wiretaps, there's typically 4 to 5 times more FISA wiretaps than law enforcement wiretaps. We're still talking about no more than a few dozen internet wiretaps at all per year, and very few, if any, internet wiretaps that through encryption have prevented the government from getting what it needs. And so it would seem that forcing internet application providers and service providers and communications providers to redesign their systems, likely at great cost and cost to security, to address such a small problem is overreacting, particularly when we haven't considered alternative modes of surveillance, such as, for example, focusing on the computer of the target rather than trying to intercept between computers. But so,
let me. I start in a slightly different place than Kevin, but I think I get to the same place quickly, which is that having been a prosecutor for 3 years and representing internet service providers for the last 10, I can acknowledge that there is a problem in the sense that there are communication paths that the government can't see and that they can't get access to and they can't get access to in real time. But we have to be aware of solutions that are worse than the problem. And any type of solution that would extend the requirement, the phone system requirement, that providers build in intercept capability into any communications technology on the internet, I think would be that kind of solution. It's far worse than the problem. The internet isn't like the phone system. With the phone system, you use it to do one thing, which is make calls. But for the internet, there's an infinite number of applications. I mean, if we just think about the common ways we use internet applications, we send email, we send instant messages, we buy and sell things on eBay, we post reviews on Yelp and TripAdvisor, we respond to private messages and Facebook friend requests. And that was just during the keynote this morning. When you get home later, we'll do a lot more, So to build in intercept capability into every single one of these internet applications in order that the government can real-time wiretap something that they need, I think is not the right approach. So I second where Kevin's going, that we don't know exactly what problem the government is trying to fight, but to the extent there's a problem with a certain type of communication that they can't see, that's not the solution. And just one other point on that is we're in 2011. Email and instant messaging have been around for a long time. The government hasn't had them covered by CLIA in the past, yet there have been solutions. We talked about the charging in the iPad case. They had access to chat transcripts. A lot of these communications are stored. A lot of these communications can be obtained by the government through the help of providers with lawful process without requiring everything to have an intercept solution.
Well, let me answer the question in terms of the impact on the private sector. I mean, three areas: security, economy, and superiority. So in terms of security, seems to suggest, the administration, FBI, DOJ, that they might have plans to weaken encryption or limit the use of encryption. And so I sort of pause and say, gee, where have I heard this before? Oh, yes, the Clipper chip, the encryption wars of the 90s. And, it didn't turn out so well then. And, what better way to undermine trust in the Internet, what better way to undermine trust in American products and services than to try to build in back doors? It's like building glass houses or, at a minimum, designing your door so that there's a peephole looking in, not out. On the economy, the proposals basically amount to another step towards the regulation of the IT industry. And that can be because of technical specifications. It can also be because of safe harbors. You don't have to do it, but if you do it, you get all these benefits. It can also result from the requirement to have standard data formats or protocols. So what's the result? You inhibit innovation. So how does that impact the economy? Well, let's remember that over the last 20 years, somewhere between a quarter and a half of productivity growth is a result of innovation and the deployment of IT. So that's a big number in terms of the impact on economic growth. It will also harm America's global competitiveness. I mean, I can't, you know, it's appropriate with the Chinese president arriving today, but, you know, it'd sort of be the biggest gift to countries, to other countries, than when the unilateral U.S. decision to give up control of the Internet. I mean, think about it. You're just inviting, first, you're inviting other countries to impose reciprocal requirements. Second, you know, what about all those foreign products? What about open source products? I mean, it's going into a fight with one hand tied behind your back, and the U.S. government would be doing the tying. It's sort of hard to imagine that we can meet our national stated goal of doubling exports in 5 years if American high-tech products and services aren't going to play a role of that. Finally, superiority. So, you know, CLIA threatens not only America's technological superiority through these tech mandates, but also its military superiority. You know, its technological superiority is threatened because, again, of the either implicit or explicit requirement for tech mandates at the antithesis of trying to do something different, faster, better, cheaper. And, you know, that's why, in fact, tech mandates have been prohibited in any number of laws. They were prohibited in CLIA 1. They were prohibited in the Homeland Security Act. They were prohibited in the E-Government Act. They were even prohibited in the Patriot Act. So to now resurrect them at this time, I think, goes in completely the wrong direction. And it also would impede and really hurt America's military superiority. I think what finally pushed the encryption wars of the 90s to a positive result was the Defense Department's realization, the military's realization, how much they are dependent on cutting-edge American technology, and that without it, they are way behind. And particularly now, in an era where we're cutting budgets, you know, we need American leading products, and the government needs to rely on those to maintain its position. So again, for the economy, superiority, and security, I think all are threatened by CLIA too.
Jeremy, could I combine it? I wanted to combine a couple of comments that these two gentlemen made.
Well, let's give Bruce just a chance, and then I'll let you jump back in.
Actually, I think everyone said they made the points very well. It's important when you look at this issue not to focus on the bad guys. I mean, it's real easy to say, you know, the bad guys are using these systems. We want to eavesdrop, therefore we should do this. But like every bit of our infrastructure, the good guys use it far more often than the bad guys. And when you build capabilities into the system, they're far more likely to be used by the good guys. And so how will the good guys, us, normal people, businesses, be affected by these requirements? I mean, we have really good comments on how it affects competitiveness. So if you can buy, right, a phone that's secure and a phone that's secure except if the FBI wants you to listen in, which one are you going to buy? Which one are you going to buy if you're not an American? Right? So the good uses really affect because they dominate. And this phone, I guess this one, right, which is secure except the FBI can listen in, has a bunch of features that this phone doesn't. And they're not necessarily good features. So it loses something called perfect forward secrecy, which is something we can do mathematically that will ensure that for this phone, when the call ends, the call is and no one has eavesdropped, it's done, it's over. So if you're worried about your business in foreign countries, you're worried about espionage, you're worried about competitors, you know, all these reasonable security concerns you have a much more secure phone than this one. Because with a government eavesdropping requirement, you lose that security feature. This phone is also more complex. We've added an additional capability. We have to make that secure. And sometimes it's not easy. Right? Phone calls are pretty easy. They go through a switch, and there's some central eavesdropping capability. Peer-to-peer systems, there's been a substantial redesign to make this system FBI-friendly. And that redesign introduces a lot of security risks and in ways we don't understand. Clipper chip is a good example. It was implemented, and over the years, researchers found some serious security flaws in them. So any type of CLIA-friendly system is going to have those risks, making this actually a much less secure option to buy. And third, and I think this is the biggie, whenever you build an eavesdropping infrastructure into a system, you can't guarantee who uses it. Right, this phone comes with secure unless the FBI wants. How do you limit it to the FBI? And there's a really good example happened in Greece in 2004. They had a cell phone system, and I think it was I forget which company sold it to them. It might have been Verizon, but maybe not. And there was an eavesdropping capability built in, and it wasn't turned on, and Greece didn't want it. It was there, but it wasn't turned on. But somebody, and we still don't know who, figured out how to turn it on. Organized crime, perhaps, a political party, perhaps, and spent a good year eavesdropping on politicians and government officials. And this is what happens when you build an insecurity into this phone. And as a security technologist, that's what worries me. I mean, it's fun to say, yeah, the FBI can do all these cool things, but you have to look at the normal uses and the normal failures, because that's what's going to dominate. It's not going to be the 30 mumble surveillance cases. It'll be the billions of legitimate users.
Let me seize on a couple of the things that you all have said and throw this back out there. Is every product has a flaw in virtually. There are all sorts of security breaches we hear about almost on a daily basis. So there is an inherent insecurity in the devices we already use. So is that...
That's an overstatement, because it's part of the system.
It's a worthy argument. I mean, yes, I mean, everything has insecurities. But we can design things so that insecurities don't become catastrophic failures. The Greek example was, once you were able to turn on an eavesdropping system, you can listen into every cell phone in the country as long as you wanted to, until somebody noticed. That's different than, you know, a Windows flaw, which is inadvertently there and might have a variety of effects. I mean, you're building in a system that allows eavesdropping, and now you've got to build a system on top of that to try to ensure that only legitimate people can make use of this system. So the layers of complexity make this a harder problem. Even though it's true, you know, any system out there is going to have vulnerabilities. I mean, we know that. We don't know how to build systems without vulnerabilities. This is substantially different and worse.
Let me flip that a little bit, because it's not that necessarily a product has a vulnerability, but you have to look at the entire system. And frankly, as hard as it is to do, you know, the whole system correctly, that also presents law enforcement with opportunities, because it's hard for the bad guys to do systems correctly too. And so, you know, if the wall's too high and you can't climb over it, okay, so you dig under it, you walk around it. So there are different ways to attack a problem, and I think law enforcement here has admitted that they have other approaches to some of these issues. I think when we go back to your question about balancing the need, we need to talk about that.
And when we talk about a system, we're not just talking about a technology system. So one of the things I do for ISPs is I train their compliance personnel. I go sit in a room a little smaller than this one with all of the people who respond to the subpoenas and wiretap orders and FISA orders that come in, and we talk about how to respond, how to judge when they're a valid order, and then what to do on the system and how to implement the order so that they get, law enforcement gets, what it is that they're asking for, assuming they have valid legal process to get it. And so in order to build a wiretap capability into a cloud computing application, it's not like the government pushes a button and then all of a sudden the information flows to them. It's that 50 paralegals read the order, and one of them will implement the order and deploy a tool on the network. And those tools are available to be exploited to the extent that the bad guys, whether it's a foreign government or a foreign hacker or an internal employee, wants to use the tool for a malicious purpose and can figure out how to get access to it. So Bruce's point about systems, it's not just the system of the phone or of the technology, it's the human system that goes with this capability, because we're talking about building a capability in that the FBI can then invoke when they present somebody with an order, and then somebody designs the tool, and then somebody implements, and somebody sends the documents, and it creates a lot of exposure in the system, not just a design flaw in a product or a backdoor in a phone.
Interesting. If you look at even back in CALEA for phone, if you look at some of the FBI justifications of why they needed wiretapping, when you dug down, a lot of their examples were room bugs, were traditional eavesdropping in rooms and cars. And that extends to computers. The vulnerabilities very much on our machines are the endpoints. It's not the network. It's, you know, I send an email to you, it's encrypted, but you're going to get it, you're going to unencrypt it on your computer, and you're going to read it. And there are lots of times we see the FBI using encrypted email in prosecutions. That's how they get it. They get it in unencrypted form at the various endpoints. And as security people,
that's at the end. That's usually at the end. It's not
the end or the beginning.
It's the end or the – well, no, I mean at the end of when they've caught them, the individual, and it's at the cases they've executed search warrants and the person has been arrested and material has been seized, whereas the FBI is arguing that they need this to find that lone wolf, to find that individual who has presented some little flag that's gone up that has on the grid of terrorism or whatever organized crime and say, we need to get that before something bad happens, as opposed to going in and collecting that machine, decrypting those messages and finding out the conspiracy or whatever.
So let me, I mean, this sort of goes, I think, a little bit to one aspect of sort of the necessity for this. And let me try to flip that and say that, you know, I think one can legitimately argue that the current problem is not too little information for law enforcement, but too much information. That, in fact, the world has gone bright, not dark on them. That there is, you know, the exponential growth in electronic communications and transactions, the access, you know, government ability to access commercial databases as well, presents just a sea of information, and it's going through what they have. It's, you know, the so-called connecting the dots that presents as a far greater problem and holds the potential for far greater benefit than, you know, trying to find the few cases, as Kevin talked about, where, you know, it may impact something. I mean, you know, the question really is, you know, is this sort of the, you know, the former vice president's 1% solution here? I mean, that so justifies imposing so great costs on so many people. And I would argue not. I would say, you know, by analogy, for example, you know, I can promise everybody in this room that we can save 20,000 American lives every year. Guaranteed. And we just impose a nationwide 30-mile-an-hour speed limit. That's it. We'll save 20,000 lives. But we're not going to do it. And we're not going to do it because of the costs and the inconvenience and the difficulty it imposes on the rest of our lives. And I think, you know, in the electronic world, the analogy is similar.
If I could bounce off a few of these things, you're far too rational for Washington, D.C., I think. But on the point of deploying these systems that can be exploited, another good example, although Google hasn't admitted it, there have been sources that have said this, that the Chinese got their way into Google's email through their lawful intercept capability, which really shows that there is a security risk that's introduced when you introduce these systems. It also highlights the question of, wait, again, what is the problem? Sure, Google isn't reached by CALEA, but it does have lawful intercept capability. And yet we know that justice is interested in Google and Facebook because they went out and visited Google and Facebook, but we haven't heard any articulation of...
Although Gmail would be covered, right? Google's email system would be.
I mean, not now. Yeah.
Not now, but under the future.
Yeah, but I'm saying to the extent there's an argument to change the law.
And also Google Docs and sort of pretty much almost everything they do.
But what I'm saying, Google already has lawful intercept capability, so why do we need a law to mandate it? On the question of alternatives, you know, compromising the endpoint and not waiting to seize the computer at the end, we've seen investigative techniques. The FBI has used remote exploits of computers for over a decade now. We first learned about this in 2007, where they tracked down someone who was making threats on MySpace, but masking his IP address. And they sent him a MySpace message and tricked him into opening it, and it installed something called CPAB on his computer. It was an IP address tracker that sent back information about his computer to the FBI. This could be done for intercept as well. And if we're talking about the issue of mobility and how mobility makes surveillance difficult for the FBI because they don't know what connection you're going to be using, it would seem that a renewed focus on compromising the device that's being used might be fruitful, particularly if we're talking about encryption, because even if it is encrypted as it goes over the network, it will be decrypted on the computer. So I think that goes to exploring other alternatives before requiring perhaps tens, if not hundreds of thousands of application developers to to modify how they write code. I mean, how many people here saw The Social Network, which I gather just won a Golden Globe for Best Picture? Imagine Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm room with his two programmer buddies if they had to worry about CALEA compliance. You know, if they had to worry about, God forbid, having to run Facebook by the FCC or the FBI before they could put it out. I mean, we're talking about thousands upon thousands of people in their metaphorical garage coding apps for us to communicate. I mean, heck, the Scrabble application has a chat function. So is this new CALEA going to reach every single way you can chat online? And if it doesn't, how is it effective? Because then the Chinese or Al-Qaeda or the Mafia or whatever, they're instead of choosing GChat, they'll use Scrabble Chat.
Yeah, but you can always tell by the words they choose.
There's an algorithm for that. I've seen it work, but no, kidding.
Can I jump in? There's one legal point that underscores what Kevin's saying that sometimes gets lost, so I think I just go back and, you know, here's your sort of one credit of law school class for this. But there's CALEA, which is the requirement that you build capability into a product. And in this case, now it applies to the phone system and broadband internet providers. And then there's the Wiretap Act, which requires providers of communications to provide necessary facilities and assistance to the government when presented with a wiretap order. And the world we live in now, as Kevin's pointing out, is one where the government can go to Google with a lawful wiretap order and says, I have an order, assist me. And Google has to assist. But to the extent it has no way of assisting, which would not be generally the case with email, right, because email is fairly easy to clone and replicate, but the extent it has no way of assisting, it doesn't have to build something on the spot. And so what Kevin's saying, the legal underpinning, is Google already has to comply with a lawful wiretap order, hey, give me Al-Qaeda's email using this email address. What they don't have to do is every time they launch a product like Google Docs or, you know, Google Book or whatever they're going to launch, social networks, or whatever they launch, they don't have to build in capability that allows real-time intercepts to take place.
And so this is sort of like the old New Yorker cartoon where there's New York and then the rest of the country there. It's the same thing. You sometimes get the impression that law enforcement sort of, here's CALEA, and we know how to deal with that, and then there's the rest of the world. But in fact, they do have access. They do have procedures, and they, in fact, work with many of those folks to get access as they need to under existing law.
And the map's actually a good metaphor, right? Because not only is there the United States, but there's the rest of the world. And we build this stuff in. It's not going to stop, Iran chat or some other country or, you know, Finland chat or from doing a similar system that doesn't have the capabilities. And the FBI not only has no access, they have no legal way to get it. So that, you know, in the global internet, this doesn't solve it. It's all face to face and walking around. A law in Washington D.C. does it pretty well, but if it's a global world and so easy to get to other places, you know, anybody that wants the security that United States systems doesn't have anymore because of this, just goes elsewhere. And the problem isn't solved. It's actually made worse because now we force the bad guys to go offshore.
Well, I also think it's important. I mean, I think law enforcement needs to be better at evaluating existing commercial developments. Yes. And how it brings benefits too. Let me go by way of analogy. A couple of years ago, there was this whole brouhaha about data retention. And I don't know if people remember, but I mean, the FBI called in the CEOs and you've got to retain data for at least 2 years. And you know, and there's a big cry about it. And then they suddenly got the idea that, oh, right, companies are retaining the data anyway for their own use. And of course, if they have it, we can get it under existing law.
So shut
we
up.
We don't need a law. Bye.
Shut up.
And I sort of get the same impression here, too. I mean, again, not only is it an explosion of data, but there are ways to get that data. And, it's just that there's sort of some lack of creativity and imagination in how to go about that.
Back to Bruce's point, and I think that's a really interesting one, that they are retaining that. But when you talk about overseas, is the horse almost at the edge of the door of the barn because of what BlackBerry has been doing by being forced by foreign governments to provide that back door?
And this is actually interesting. So the BlackBerry story is that they, for their enterprise system, they basically will outsource BlackBerry servers, and companies do themselves within the local countries. For their generic users, it goes through BlackBerry system. And countries who, you know, the U.S. is certainly one of them, but Russia, China, India, Saudi Arabia, I mean, not a great list, have demanded that BlackBerry give these countries access. And BlackBerry will say, no, we can't do that. And countries like India say, well, we're going to kick you out. And then BlackBerry has to decide, is the market worth it? And they've reached agreements with countries like India, and agreements certainly mean the country's going to get access. And they've done that by putting servers in those countries. So instead of making a technical change, they made a geographic change. That so now the data is in unencrypted form in those servers in India, so Indian law applies, and whatever mechanisms happen, happen. And so this is an interesting example. And once, because once this happens, now every country can ask. Right? Now the excuse that we can't do this is obviously not true. So any totalitarian country can say, we demand access. And BlackBerry is forced to say, yeah, we know how to do it. We can do it for you. Or they would leave the market. And that sort of thing certainly will happen in all systems, that we tend to see the minimum of the requirements because that's how it's designed. Now, in the United States is a big country, so a lot of stuff happens here. BlackBerry was a Canadian company. A lot of stuff happens in the U.S. now. But the nexus might move. If it moves to Europe, if it moves to countries that are much more privacy-friendly, you could see them saying, no, we will give up certain markets. If they're setting themselves up in opposition to the eavesdrop-ready American products, they might cede the American market and use it as a competitive advantage in the world. It'd be interesting to watch how the business plays out, because there are business reasons why you'd want to do both, why you'd want to be friendly to American law enforcement, or why you'd want to give up America and say to the rest of the world, we're not America.
So then you might also talk about, on the corporate side, with BlackBerry, where BlackBerry itself doesn't have access to the information. Right. It's the companies that have purchased the system and are running the system that have access to the information.
So similar to a corporate mail server. Right? So in the BlackBerry system, the email is encrypted as it runs through the network, and it's decrypted at servers to get routed. And for the corporate system, what makes you like your corporate email system? If you have, let's say, PGP going between companies, when it hits your corporate server, it gets decrypted and gets shifted around. So a lot of countries like India have ceded, IBM, who might have their BlackBerry server in the United States, in the UK, they might have a few around the world. And they might have given up on that, thinking they'll be able, if there's a problem, go to the corporate offices in Delhi and say, we need email. We need to see the email of this person. Right? They're not really concerned about companies, they're concerned about individuals. So what we're seeing, and I think what you want to take away from this, is that companies like BlackBerry build their systems in ways that make sense for the technology and for their market. And if they're forced to make changes because a government says you must make a change, that will be different degrees of easy or hard, depending on what it is. BlackBerry's pretty centralized, and so it wasn't that hard to redesign. A strict peer-to-peer system might be impossible to redesign. I mean, Skype would not exist as it exists today with law enforcement eavesdropping capability, because you couldn't build it as a peer-to-peer communication system. You have to build something different, and it might or might not work.
Kevin, you want to jump in? Yeah, on the international aspect, I just wanted to also highlight a key irony in this situation where the U.S. government seems to have very different perspectives on the value of encryption, whether it's us using it or people outside the country using it. Because, 2 weeks before the CALEA proposal, as it were, was first reported in the New York Times, you had the State Department strongly condemning United Arab Emirates for their attacks on BlackBerry. State Department and the U.S. military and diplomatic corps generally have been very supportive of strong privacy-protective communications technologies for dissidents in more authoritarian or repressive regimes. I mean, heck, EFF works often with the developers of Tor, which is a proxy network that was first developed by naval intelligence. Yet, when we start talking about domestic communications technology, oh, well, for that we need a back door. And that doesn't make any sense to me.
The definition of an offensive weapon is the direction it's pointing. We know that.
What are the risks of consumers abandoning certain products? I mean, Bruce, you alluded to this towards the beginning, but of consumers abandoning certain services or applications or products because it does have this back door? Or is that just a sort of a lesser concern?
I think it's lesser concern. I mean, the great example, of course, is Facebook, which has made the crappiest privacy. If you would write crappy privacy, that's what you'd end up with. And users are flocking to it. I mean, they complain a lot. There are revolts. There are protests. And then after 3 weeks, they seem to die. So I think the social aspects of the system overcome the privacy concerns for individuals. Businesses, I think, are going to make different decisions. They're going to be much more likely to go to a more privacy-friendly system, especially if they're multinational, because they're not just concerned about the United States, they're concerned about it, but lots of countries. And they're concerned about competitors where the rules of espionage are different. So they're more likely to jump. Governments are more concerned. Individuals, it's going to depend. You could easily see, you know, if there is two equal choices to take the more privacy-friendly. But for social sites, people go where their friends are. That's the way they seem to work.
One risk is that the products themselves don't come to market. And just to back up a step, I mean, this is sort of unparalleled agreement on a panel. I'd say to the net, you've never seen a panel like this where there's just nobody disagreeing with anybody. So that's happening is we're all painting the edge scenario where the government says, okay, CLIA mandates have to apply to all technology. And so we're using that, and everybody agrees that's a really bad thing. And so in light of your question, which is will consumers abandon technology, it's that if that were the case, the edge technologies wouldn't make their way to market. And I'm not just talking about the small garage developers or Mark Zuckerberg wouldn't launch, you know, Facebook in his dorm room, but large companies who let developers go off and play because it's not costing the company anything and say, go come back with a product, and if it works, we'll see if we want to launch it. And they launch it, and then all of a sudden it's got a million users and like, oh, wait, this might be interesting. That won't happen because in order to launch that product, it has to have regulatory requirements, capabilities, a compliance solution, a compliance team supporting it, an in-house lawyer, and then all of a sudden you're like at $800,000 of fixed cost to put a product even out the door, and this isn't our core business. We're not doing this. So that's what the concern is, and that's not a concern if, and again, I'll start to diverge a little bit, if the CLIA solution is a lot more narrowed and tailored, and any service with over 100 million users must have intercept capability, then you're not going to avoid launching because everyone's going, we'll never get to 100 million, and they'll launch.
Let me just follow up on that point precisely, because I think it's very instructive to go back over the evolution of CLIA 1 in that regard. Is there going to be new CLIA legislation? I mean, we can talk about that a little bit. Frankly, I think law enforcement and the administration's gotten much better about selectively using and leaking particular cases to generate some momentum for the things. You know, we can legislate in haste and repent at leisure. But, you know, the initial CLIA law could not have been, I think, more explicit about excluding information services. Take you back to the mid-90s, but it excluded information services. You can ask Jim Dempsey, you can ask Beryl Howell. They wrote it. They excluded it. And yet, what happened? Over time, under sort of relentless FBI, DOJ pressure to the FCC turned around and adopted what I believe was an incredibly tortured statutory construction. And yet, it was upheld by the conservative D.C. Circuit. So I think, again, you have to realize that if there is a so-called narrow CLIA 2 provision, over time you're going to again face pressure at the FCC and in the courts to broaden it as the administration, as law enforcement pushes to expand those borders. And that is essentially then puts an obligation back on folks in this room, back on industry, back on the private sector to continually being sort of on guard to, you know, exercise vigilance and diligence to not let that happen, but there are barriers to that happening.
I also wanted to bounce off the characterization of a narrowing, because I mean, by number of users, because this is something we might actually see, but it seems rather senseless to me. We have this problem with sophisticated computer criminals using tactics to evade our interception. So we're going to pass something that will only cover the most popular services that consumers and the really dumb criminals and terrorists use, and not actually address the problem of sophisticated attackers who were unable to see. I mean, again, you cover Gmail and Facebook, then you're just going to have Al-Qaeda using Scrapple Chat. It's and a 90% solution, something that covers most services, is still not going to address the core problem that they claim to have, but is going to severely impact innovation, severely impact security, to apparently little end.
Just to clear, I wasn't suggesting that.
No.
I'm as opposed to everybody else, but I just want to say we can't always fight this, you know, discussion as if they're going to come up with the one end, the most extreme, everything's covered. We also have to have our arguments for when they're going to do something more.
Right. Two related points. I mean, the notion of criminal masterminds, I think, is vastly overstated. I mean, we tend to get our visions of what criminals are like from television and movies. That's where we get them. You know, criminals generally aren't like that. I mean, it's not a good career path. You don't get good training. You know, I mean, you practice and you get it wrong, you go to jail. I mean, it's not like becoming a plumber. I mean, you don't. So these sorts of criminal masterminds you see in the comic books, that isn't the way the world works, and they're much rarer than we think because of our visual stimuli. The second, and I think I lost the second.
Okay, well, I'll interject on that point just to throw this out there. It's not necessarily in a terrorism case, but we have seen in this massive unfolding insider trading case out of Wall Street, a much more sophisticated approach. Now, some of it's very traditional emails, discussions, and face-to-face, but there is some potential there in a very financially lucrative and damaging area of criminal activity.
And I think you're more likely to see it there than terrorism. But there you'll have the added vulnerabilities of the very public nature of what's being done, the large conspiracies. You mean you'll more likely get whistleblowers. More likely the traditional investigative techniques start working a lot better against that sort of crime. The other point, I think it was made a little earlier in another way, that for the past, 25 years, the NSA and FBI have been whining about communications not being available. Yet every year, more and more is available. I mean, just the amount of stuff we do electronically that we didn't do before, the amount of digital footprints we leave through our lives as we go through our day, is enormous and gets bigger every year. So there really isn't a good case made, except, you know, with anecdotes that tend not to hold up, of why this is so required. What is the need here? the case, I think, appeals to our notion of movie plots. It's like the terrorists with crop dusters. I mean, right, we can imagine that, and it gets us scared. But how realistic are these threats? And the case really has not been made by the FBI that this is a problem.
Well, let's. I'm going to ask one more question, then we'll open up to the audience for some questions because time is moving quickly. And this is probably more geared to Mark, Kevin, and Bruce, is the legislative landscape. There will have to be a Patriot Act renewal. Well, the potential of a Patriot Act renewal later this year. I think it expires in April, the current end of February. Okay, sorry, off a little bit. I was hoping for spring early. And so there's the potential that this could get tacked into that, and there is a tremendous amount of pressure, from what I hear, on the Hill to do something about this and address, and the FBI is obviously waging a rare public campaign to get this included. What's the legislative outlook? What are you telling your clients from Mark or Bruce? And then, Kevin, I'll let you weigh in with what you're hearing from the Hill.
I think Kevin started it by saying we don't have a concrete proposal yet. Okay. And so the lack of a proposal coming out of an interagency process in the government, the lack of the administration getting behind whatever the FBI is talking about, makes it very hard to forecast where this is going because we don't know what it is yet. You're right that the FBI has mounted an unprecedented campaign and gone to the press and has talked about the need for it, but it's just so hard to read the tea leaves of a legislative when there's no proposal draft bill.
Let's put the proposal aside for just a moment. The nuts and bolts. What is the legislative the climate on the Hill for doing something like this, especially with the shift in the control of the House and a narrower Democratic majority, which one would tend to argue would side more with the civil liberties privacy angle, but not always.
I mean, I would point to the early 90s where you had a similar situation where you had a Democratic president and a primarily Republican Congress, and that did create a perfect storm for the passage of a administration-backed proposal that many in the civil liberties community were very upset with. And so I think that risk is here to the extent the administration does come out behind a proposal. That hasn't happened yet. They are apparently working towards something. We have no idea whether it will be as broad as Valerie Caprotti at the FBI's wildest dreams or something much narrower. And so it's kind of hard to judge the process. I think what's certain is there are likely to be hearings on Kalia. I mean, we have several chairs already saying that. And so the issue's not going to go away.
I think, you know, it was interesting. Kalia won. The relevant committees were the Judiciary Committees and the Commerce Committees. I think, though, particularly if it's tied in with Patriot Act, what you need to be wary of is something coming out of the Intelligence Committees or the Defense Committees. And, you know, what one is worried about is an amendment that appears late in the process and tries to get rammed through. I will say that within the administration, it's terrific that there's an interagency process. I think there's little doubt, and, you know, delighted that everybody is being represented at the table. No doubt that it's law enforcement, the FBI, DOJ, that's driving it with probably a, you know, behind-the-scenes push from the Intel folks. I think it is incumbent upon people who share concerns that I think we've sort of articulated here to become more active on this. And, you know, again, it goes back to that imbalance. I mean, the law enforcement folks have a single agenda, and they're pushing ahead. I think a lot of the companies, a lot of the folks in the private sector have multiple issues, multiple priorities. They have to decide how big a problem is this going to be for them, and they need to speak up about it, and they need to be active about it.
So I think the lack of proposal is what you get. I mean, I think that's the way it works. And I think it serves the interests of those pushing it very well. I mean, the proposal is, do you want us to eavesdrop on terrorists when they use the Internet? And everyone says, oh, yeah, it's a good idea. And it's, of course, there's nothing to criticize because there's nothing there. And what actually shows up in legislation, I agree, could show up very easily late in the process. What gets voted on isn't necessarily what gets dealt with in reconciliation or what gets dealt with in rulemaking, and whatever's in there, I don't think you know what you get until it's too late to do anything about it. And that's my worry with sort of all of these types of things, that, you know, we can sit here debating and crafting language and legislation, but that might have nothing to do with what happens at the end of the process. And that's, to me, that's where this is worrisome. So this lack of a proposal, I think for the FBI, this is a feature, not a bug.
Just a shout out to CDT and Greg, who's done a great job in running a DIPSWIG and trying to pull various interests together who share concerns about this. But I think
DIPSWIG,
yes, Digital Privacy and Security Working Group.
Wow.
But,
just when we thought we killed all the acronyms possible.
I do think if this is not going to happen, I think the level of activity, the level of volume, has to be increased in order to oppose this successfully.
We've got a few more minutes for the panel, and I would invite anyone who has questions to please take the microphone, or come on up to the microphone, identify who you are, and the FBI will be listening.
Hi, Greg Nogent.
Please speak directly into the coffee cup in front of your seat.
Thanks for the shout out. I have a question. What if the proposal is more scalpel-like than hammer-like? And it goes something like this. What we want is for justice. What we want is for the Attorney General to be able to name specific applications or services that we've had trouble with. So we're not going after the whole economy, Bruce. It's not going to be that. It's just going to be these specific handful that we've had trouble with. And you get named, and then you got 15 days to comply, and if you still haven't complied, then we're going to go to court and prove there's no reasonable alternative. Say that's the proposal.
Who pays?
I think that's a completely unbounded thing. That legislation would basically give the authority to the Attorney General to make make that demand, to pursue those, to name those names. What limits that? I mean, you could name them in legislation. I mean,
but is
I don't
that really
see any
different from what
that.
The FBI has today to be able to go out there and subpoena information and say,
but it's different than subpoena.
And reasonable alternative. Who decides what a reasonable alternative is?
Oh, that'd be me.
I mean, it's
judge.
Well, there's you know.
Go ahead.
One comment. It's not an absurd question by any means. This is one, the English system, the RIPA system that they use for wiretaps involves tapping providers and giving them a reasonable period of time to build capabilities in their system because they've been demonstrated to be a provider whose systems are being used for criminal activity. I think what you hear everybody mumbling about is the question of executive discretion. That is, that proposal sounds very different if it's the AG is authorized to move a court to make a showing, to have the court find that this is a communications technology that's being used for these purposes and therefore should build alternatives versus somebody just deciding, investing all the discretion in the executive branch. I think it's a more difficult proposal to combat and argue with to the extent it's built in with the same type of showing that the Wiretap Act itself requires. And we think about what are the ramifications of that if there is adequate process around it. But I think the way you've described it, everybody knee-jerk reactions is that can't work.
Well, I agree. I mean, if I were them, I'd do something like you said, because it's harder to oppose. But I think the practical effects are as deleterious.
Sure. Hi, Tim Sparapane. I'd like to ask two macro questions. I'm enjoying the discussion, so thank you all very much. First, how does, if at all, the impending end of Director Mueller's tenure affect what you think will happen? I think that's September of this year. I think you started right around 9/11, and it's been 10 years. Second point, how, if at all, do you think the what looks like it's going to be a wide-open Republican presidential primary and the corresponding debates that will occur within the Republican Party affect this series of discussions? Thanks.
Well, I'll take
that Mueller question was on my list. I didn't get to it.
I'll take the second one first. I mean, I think it's actually really interesting, and I don't think you can just, you know, you can't just say it's a conservative Republican, so they're going to be with the DOJ.
Right, because it's kind of anti-business.
It's anti-business, and you know, I mean, there's a grassroots movement here. I mean, again, you go back to the 90s and how that all played out. You had some very conservative folks who were on our side. I will say, you know, one advantage here is you now have Bob Goodlatte, who sort of, you know, came of age and learned all about encryption back in the 90s, chair of the relevant subcommittee on judiciary now. So I think, you know, and Bob Goodlatte is a conservative Republican. He'd tell you so. So I'm not sure how it – I think it's actually pretty individualized that way. I don't think it's sort of reflexive in that nature. In terms of Mueller, I don't know. I think it – I mean, I think from his perspective, he will continue to push hard. He is. This has always been a burn him. He's always hated encryption. It just gets red when he talks about it. You know, I guess one question is sort of, you know, how old is the new director going to be? And, you know, how technically savvy? I mean, I think back to Louis Freeh, who didn't use email and yet, you know, complained about it a lot. So.
And does Val Caproni stay for a transition period? Who is one of the biggest pushers of this?
Yeah.
Last question.
Yeah, hi. Rodney Small, FCC. I had the great pleasure of working on CALEA until about 4 years ago. Happily, I'm no longer working on it. But just as a point of historical fact, it was actually the 1994 Congress that passed CALEA, which was not a Republican Congress. It was a Democrat Congress. And Louis Freeh was Bill Clinton's FBI director. He was one of the strongest proponents of it.
That's right.
But I guess the question I have is you could make a strong case that CALEA was never even meant to apply to the Internet. But essentially, as far as I can tell, law enforcement has won every battle. And I think the question, the issues you're raising, I mean, you're kind of saying this is something new. We can't do this. And yet it was the same thing that was raised about the Internet in the first place. So what makes you think you're going to win this time?
The approach is a little different this time. The approach all along has always been at the edge. Interception capability at the edge. With the phone system, it was at the edge. And to the extent the Internet battle was lost, as you put it the first time, it was because the Internet was the edge. Broadband providers were providing the connectivity to the home. But now you're talking about going into the development of software programs, applications, everything that rides on the backbone of the Internet and saying there has to be Internet capability all the way through. And that seems a whole lot different to people, not just the people up here, I think, than intercept capability at the edge. No one is trying to roll back the, well, maybe people are, but this is part of the discussion, to roll back the, okay, if you provide edge connectivity, you have to have an Internet solution. But just to make the analogy further, in the phone system, okay, when there was a phone wiretap, the provider turned over the phone line. And the FBI didn't go back and say, oh, wait a second, they're speaking Spanish. Also translate that for me. It was the FBI's job to translate it, whether it was a common language like Spanish or whether it was a more obscure language. And now the FBI is saying, okay, I have edge capability, but they're speaking IMAP protocol. They're speaking, you know, Google Talk, and I can't understand that. And so what's the consequence of that? Should the FBI learn how to intercept Google Talk and figure it out? Should Google build an intercept capability? Or should the phone company translate everything that goes over the wire? And that's the discussion we're having. So I don't think it's the same as should there be intercept capability at the edge.
Jerry, and if we can get quick responses from
that. Yeah, I want to underscore that it did happen in 1994, so it was Democrats were in charge of everything. And so people should remember that. Secondly, the first question was with respect to the White House, would the Attorney General would be able to control it. That was the FBI's original proposal in 1993 when they came up to the Hill. And one of the battles was where to locate this authority, and it was decided that, no, it did not make sense to put it in the Justice Department. It made sense to put it in the FCC because at least it would be a transparent fight and there would be a relatively neutral decision maker. Assuming that this broad consensus, this violent agreement that has broken out on your panel, that it's not going to go anywhere and there's no need, doesn't hold, and the Justice Department has some sway, I'd like you to comment on if this authority has to be located somewhere, where would that authority be and what process would go around that?
I mean, I first want to make a prefatory note, which is we don't know what the authority is yet. we don't have a proposal. We're now hearing a hypothetical proposal that would locate some sort of authority with the AG or the FCC, but we don't know what standards it has in it, what capabilities it would require, et cetera, et cetera. So that does make it very, very hard to actually attack the proposal because we don't know what it is. But as to your direct question, does anyone else have a good response to that?
I think the same argument, transparency is better. It has to be somewhere. It should be somewhere we can see it. You know, sitting in a secret court or sitting in Homeland Security or Justice seems more dangerous than somewhere in Commerce.
Well, actually, bouncing off that point, I mean, one of the big concerns about the way CALEA in practice has gone forward since the 90s is, you know, the J standard, the standard for intercept capabilities, was essentially negotiated privately between the phone companies and Justice, and then they went to FCC and said, here, this is what we want. That should not be the case if this happens again. There needs to be a clearer, more transparent process so that it's not just a few powerful stakeholders in secret determining answering these very important questions.
Because you can imagine the big stakeholders using this as for anti-competition. If they can build a barrier that keeps startups from entering and becoming competitors, they will use this for that purpose. I mean, it's probably a reasonable thing to twist this to use.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate it. I want to remind you that next up is the networking lunch and keynote speakers with Congressman Goodlatte, Howard Schmidt, who's the cybersecurity coordinator at the White House, and
Ed
Amoroso, who is the chief security officer at AT&T.
And generically brilliant person.